Hello, you're listening to The Skeptical Naturopath with Dr. Paul Rite and Laura Pomathis. And Laura, you're brand new to the show here. Christina's kind of on hiatus now. She's living in Milwaukee, and it's always kind of more of a scheduling issue to get together. But I'm so grateful to have you along for the ride, and hopefully you will enjoy this ride a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so you are listening to WDRT 91.7, 91.9. Oh, my gosh, I got it wrong. I just said in Viroqua, Wisconsin. And today we're going to talk about the modern childhood mismatch. This is actually a, I guess, a lecture seminar that I gave at Pleasant Ridge Waldorf School back in April. So I always like to double dip. So this is a way that I've kind of already gave this presentation, and we can get just kind of talk about it and go into more detail about this. So anyways, maybe Laura, do you want to introduce yourself and tell me, like, what's your interest to even hanging out with me here? So
well, you're just fun. Well, yeah, so I'm a dietitian. I have been dietitian for, I think, 17 years now. Something
Yay.
Like that. Yeah, it's something around there. I teach nutrition at Youth Initiative, and I like to tell them I've been a dietitian longer than they've been alive. So, yeah, and I'm in the, you know, of course, you know, connected to you. I'm in the holistic health world. I have a private practice, and my primary focus is on gut health and supporting digestion. And
Yay!
And, you know, I do a lot with teaching about fermentation. I do, you know, classes, and I do a lot of food writing as well, and just talking about, I just love to talk about food and health, and I'm excited to have another medium to do that.
Great.
With somebody awesome to talk to.
Oh, wow. I'm so grateful. So, yeah, I mean, this is the idea, you know, as a naturopath, I kind of get stuck in this, you know, in the supplement world, right? It's like, oh, what supplement do I need to take? And supplements, oh my gosh, the cost of them. And that just, it's a little overwhelming to me, and I kind of understand them. But again, it kind of goes back to, you know, I think there's three principles, right? It's what you think, it's how you move, it's what you eat, right? That's the ground floor. Everything else kind of is gravy, perhaps, and not that supplements don't help, but they're not replacing kind of this healthy lifestyle. So
absolutely.
Oh my gosh.
I think that, you know, like in my practice, that first piece, how you think, is one of the things I'm really trying to target a lot, because people come to me who have been working on the movement and diet, and I'm like, yeah, you're not getting better because you're a little stress ball, or, you know, or your thinking patterns are super negative, or there's like unchecked issue, you know, like trauma or whatever, something stuck. And that how you think piece is huge, and I'm glad that that's one of your three big pieces.
Isn't it amazing working with patients that, you know, you kind of get this, I get my intake form and I got like, you know, 10 spots for them to put what's going on. And you're like, how does all this working, or how does this all fit? And they always fill like all 10 spots, right? And then they're writing even more on there. Like, what are your chief complaints? But then you hear their story, right? And then the story, right, is kind of like, oh, this kind of makes sense.
Absolutely.
And then there's sort of the sense, maybe, you know, there's sort of the archetypes, right? There's people that I see that I'm like, oh, I've seen you before. You've seen me before? Well, not you, but this presentation is nothing out of the ordinary for me. So
absolutely. And that's why, like, I made an online course, actually, because I kept seeing the exact same archetype.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why don't I streamline this for everybody? Because I know what you're going to tell me. And this isn't like a put down. It's like, but there's the same story over and over. And I'm like, we can streamline this. And I think that story of how we got to where we are with our, you know, whatever health condition, or, you know, whatever the chief complaint is, it has a lot to do with like what we're talking about today, is the childhood mismatch. Like, when people come to probably either of us, these things didn't start in the last couple of weeks.
No.
They've been building since their childhood.
Yes.
And there's this big story there. Like, I love that you use that word. And I think That has that kind of weaves perfectly into kind of what we're talking about.
Yeah,
today.
Right. Narrative medicine. So they call it narrative medicine. There's actually a frame for that. Ooh. You could get a master's degree in narrative medicine. I think at New York University, somewhere out in New York.
Mm,
but it's very interesting. There's a journal. I don't know what the journal is. It narrative medicine. I can't remember, but it's super interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But it's funny that it's now a study. It's a study, you know, it's a master's degree instead of like, oh, I just need to learn how to like tell stories and hear stories and solicit stories.
Yeah.
Anyways, but let's talk about children.
Yeah.
And the great thing about children is what? It's like super easy, or well, maybe not easy, straightforward. Right? Because it's not so many layers on the onion.
Not yet,
right? So let's prevent some of those onion layers from forming, right?
Yep.
So again, I think that this cuts us, even though we're talking about childhood mismatch, it's just like this is just a mismatch for everybody,
mm-hmm.
right? And I guess I just read this. So modern childhood mismatch, why kids are struggling and what actually helps. So we talked about that a little bit before, like, are children struggling? Like, I think, like, is this a rhetorical, like, I'm putting that out there, like, oh, they're struggling, we need to do all this. And, you know, so there's this sense for sure, maybe more about adaptation, right? It's the environment has changed so quickly on us, or it's continuing to change very
quickly.
And can we keep up with it, right? Can we, and how do we adapt to this, right? I mean, I've been a naturopath like 28 years, I think. So again, it's curious how many different things that I've seen and things that sort of come up and just sort of how the shift has happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, just the acceleration of this, right? And certainly now with the AI thing too, right? I mean, that's just a whole nother layer mm-hmm. on this. But what do you think? I mean, is it the struggling thing? What's your perspective?
I do think a lot of kids are struggling, and what that means may mean different things to different people. But first of all, as we talked about kind of before we started recording, you know, we're in a little bit of a bubble here in Viroqua, and I'm sure there's a lot of little bubbles all over
yes.
in different communities. But, you know, we see a lot of really healthy, robust kids. But even within there, you know, in that kind of bubble, there's a lot of struggle. But when I go out into the larger world, I really feel like kids are struggling, whether that's like they just seem unhappy. Maybe they seem unwell. They're sick all the time. They are pale. They have dark circles under their eyes. They are unsettled. They don't, there's so many kind of lenses for, are these kids struggling? But I mean, it seems like they are.
Yeah.
There's chronic illness. And I know we're going to probably dive into the different kinds of, you know, illness and stressors in kids, but it just seems like chronic depletion and, yeah. What do you think? Do you think that kids are struggling?
Yeah, I do, right? I mean, I kind of chose that word, the struggling piece. I just want to put it out there, right? Oh, our kids are struggling, right? It's just like what they're maladapting, right?
Yeah.
And maybe that's a better word, is that how are they meeting the challenges of this environment mm-hmm. that's being produced these days, right? So, and again, right, I think that, here's interesting. Do you know the book Doris Rapp, Is This Your Child? Did you ever... I mean, this is a really old book. I'm sure it's from the 70s. I mean, this came up when I was in school. I remember that. Is This Your Child? And there was the picture of the child on the cover of the book, right? And he's got like allergic shiners. You can just see his faces drawn mm-hmm. out. And I'm like, oh my God. And through time now, I mean, I've seen that child like hundreds of times, mm-hmm. right? That's the presentation. So this is the kind of thing when you talk about food and gut, right? Super important thing, right? But I don't know if you find this, like I'm in an environment with new children. I'm looking at children. I'm like, oh, food allergy here, right? Because you can almost...
Airway
issue, right? It's almost like the morphology, right? You can look at children and you can say, whoa, something's not right, right? And we see that development. And that's the whole teeth thing and the whole, you know, facial structure and all these things is super, super interesting. But but anyways, I get caught up in the food thing, right? I mean, definitely nutrition too, right? And about what are you putting in your mouth and what's going on. And that's one part of it. But I think we want to explore, you know, all these other parts. So, I mean, and what are we struggling with, right? So I think sleep, super important issue, sleep disorders, sleep problems. And mm-hmm. I see that all the time in adults as well.
Sure.
Anxiety, depression, right? This kind of thing. And attention focus issues. really super interesting, right? I mean, I certainly have ADHD, and I didn't really know that until I got to college, and then it became a problem. Like high school, I didn't have any issues, but all of a sudden now I'm being challenged. I'm like, whoa, I don't want to read that. And, but anyway, so I mean, I can relate to that, and I, of course, see that in my children as well, too. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is like, there's sort of this, of course, the blueprint, but we kind of see this, and it's like, oh, it's manifesting. Like your brain's kind of like my brain a little bit here, right? And what is that brain like? So I don't know. And I mean, definitely if we talk food-wise, I mean, that's an input piece where we could talk about the microbiome, which I love to geek out about you too, right? Yeah. Fermented foods and everything along those lines. But I don't know. What other things do you think would be on there that you're seeing?
Yeah, definitely movement. I think.
Yeah, movement deficiency, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And nature deficiency. Yeah, nature. And I think just also unrealistic expectations of different developmental phases, and I think, or just lack of understanding of different developmental phases, like what is developmentally appropriate for a child. It's definitely not sitting inside 8 hours when they're three or 4 years old, you know. So I think there's a lot of this, you know, you talk about adaptation. It's like, I don't see how these kids could possibly adapt, or how, you know, humans could possibly adapt to how, you know, starkly different things are now than they were, you know, hundreds or thousands of years ago. And I think, you know, certainly, yeah, food, movement, sleep, attachment, you know, being with, you know, your central parent figures, the mother for, you know, long periods of time. And, you know, it's, I mean, some of this stuff starts in utero and in the birth. And so, I mean, there's a lot of layers, but I think, you know, the food and movement are super important. But like you said, all these other pieces are there too. Sleep, screens.
Screens.
So, yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
Terrible.
Yeah.
So I'll comment here. So I remember I've seen, you know, I saw, I don't know, a while ago, 5-year-old type 2 diabetic, right? 5 years old.
Oh.
And, you know, type 2 diabetes, we used to call this adult onset diabetes, right? We can't call it adult onset diabetes any longer. So this 5-year-old presents to my clinic, and I'm like, so you could already tell me, right, what was going on with both parents. What do you think about both parents? Both parents, type 2 diabetics, right? So that there's sort of the sense like, oh, that's just the way it is. But that's super interesting. That's 5 years, right? 5 years plus 9 months. I'm going to say in utero, super important with blood sugar regulation and this kind of thing. Gestational diabetes, this all this issue. But just the whole idea of that it took 5 years plus 9 months to get to that level that and we now have a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. And you're like, what is wrong? Yeah. Is this a child? Like, is this just the blueprint and the genes and this is going to happen? I think, oh my gosh, what's that exposure been for the last, you know, 5.5 years?
Yeah.
Like that's the environment piece, right?
Yeah.
That's the environment. And we may say, well, you need to move more. And of course, movement is super important and it helps use the blood sugar, right? This kind of thing. But still on another level, it's not just the exercise, right? It's still, I think, you know, the food that's being ingested there as an example.
And there's the idea of like, of epigenetics. It's like, the gene can be there, but we have the power to turn it on and off. And I think all these mismatches you have been talking, you know, you talk about in your lecture are these things that are going to turn these on and off. Because 5 years feels like lightning speed to me to just trash a pancreas.
Oh my gosh.
And especially with, you know, they're not even eating food in the first 6 months. So, but that's a whole nother thing, talking about breast milk versus formula. You know, like what we're inputting immediately is shaping the microbiome. It's shaping the blood sugar regulation immediately. And everything just feels like it's backwards right
now. So how about we start with the microbiome?
Okay.
I mean, I got my list of five, but I love the microbiome.
Yeah.
I know you love the microbiome too. So, I mean, so this microbiome thing, I mean, I've been given probiotics for, you know, 28 years, right? This is nothing new. And what's the magic probiotic? No magic probiotic. I mean, some work better than others. Some work better for some patients and not other patients. I don't know, right? So, but it's still this idea like, oh, I have to take bacteria. But the interesting aspect of this is, you know, what is that microbiome and how do we influence that, right? And I think that this is I mean, the supplement industry is certainly interested in that and trying to, you know, foster that. But how do we create a healthy microbiome? And that microbiome is so important for immune function and neural development and all these other things, right? We talk about, you know, the first brain upstairs. And what do we talk about the gut? I mean, we call it the second brain.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of curious, like, maybe that's the first brain, and what's upstairs is the second brain,
yeah.
right? I mean, the sensory organs, right? I mean, our sensory system, and again, we do have a lot concentrated in the head, but how much is going on in the gastrointestinal tract, right? I mean, so many things are being transacted in that environment, right? Which has a surface area of like a tennis court, if you took it and spread it out, because that small intestine is all like, it's just, you know, it's all the shag carpeting, if I like to say, right? We like to see shag carpeting in that small intestine. We don't like Berber, right? We don't want Berber rug. Yeah. That's a problem, right? But anyways, there's so much information that's being transacted there. I mean, we could talk in the stomach and the hydrochloric acid and the bile and then the digestive enzymes in the pancreas. So we've got breakdown, we've got absorption, and we kind of have this microbiome kind of at the end, right, in the large intestine. And it's funny, we've got SIBO, right? SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, which is basically like, well, that's actually good bacteria in the wrong place.
Yeah.
Right?
It's too much of it.
And so now we're like, well, wait a minute. Don't we want good bacteria? But now, oh, wait, it's in the small intestine.
Mm-hmm.
Again, right? What's good in one place may not be good somewhere else too, right? So, but we really need to, you know, sort of foster that. So then we have the microbiome in the large intestine. And again, you can take probiotics, fermented food, right? So super valuable on that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, is that microbiome set? And, you know, does it change? And this is what I think is part of the adaptability, right? Or adaptation is that microbiome is constantly shifting based on what it's being presented with, right? So it's, I mean, I talk about it as like a fingerprint, but I'm not even sure it's a fingerprint because a fingerprint doesn't change, right? So this is this idea that it's this milieu, it's this environment where things are, you know, being transacted and information. And then, you know, what's the best way to influence that? Do we just drink kombucha or, you know, do we eat sauerkraut, which are helpful? But what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, especially I think about with, you know, talking about children, you know, I run a lot of stool tests with my clients, and, you know, they kind of say in the first 6 months to a year, don't even bother with the stool test because the microbiome changes so rapidly. So it's like, you know, that's really interesting to think about. That also means it's highly influenceable too. And so, you know, in children, I think fermented foods are great. You know, when you're introducing first foods around 6 months, introducing fermented foods as some of the first foods, sauerkraut juice, even before they can chew sauerkraut and yogurt and kefir. But I also think, you know, for children, you know, some of the best ways to positively influence their microbiome is drinking breast milk from the breast, and because that directly influences the microbiome, and doing that for as long as possible, because that's where the really core of, I think, a child's microbiome comes from their first food and their first, you know, contact with skin is the mother's microbiome. And so I think breastfeeding is one of the best things, and then once food's introduced, like I said, getting fermented foods in there. But I think, I mean, for me, and I'm, of course, I'm definitely curious to hear what you think, but I think for a child, other than that, the best way to positively influence their microbiome is getting them outside in nature all the time. And of course, not introducing unnecessary antibiotics and not, you know, bleaching your house, you know, not overly, you know, being overly, you know, overly clean, I guess, with disinfectants and hand sanitizer and all that stuff. But I think getting them in nature is one of the best ways to positively influence a child's microbiome.
Yeah, think about that. So we talk about the immune system a lot, right? And it's funny that the things that affect the immune system are also the things that are affecting the microbiome, right? So the issue is should we even be targeting the immune system? I mean, yeah, on some level, but the whole idea is what causes that immune system to be upregulated or out of whack or that kind of thing. And the microbiome is kind of that in between, right? That is that protective, if you want to call it protective layer on the GI tract, to just say, what are we letting in or what are we not letting in? And again, understand that's more in the large intestine rather than the small intestine. So the small intestine is sort of, this is where we absorb. Mm-hmm. I mean, we do some absorption in the large intestine, but it's different. But that's the kind of that population. It's almost like that's our seeding area, right? So that's the place where there's this whole, like, I kind of use kind of anthroposophy, this sulfur tendency, right? Sulfur is really that represents the metabolic system, right? There's like changing and it's like a jungle and it's this kind of thing, right? Whereas thinking is more sort of like quartz. It's kind of like clear. It's a reflection. It's, you know, this kind of thing. And then we've got this jungle in the GI tract in the, I mean, certainly that large intestine is a metaphor for that. Our microbiome is a metaphor for that, right? So again, if we're targeting the immune system, we almost always need to be targeting that microbiome, right? And seeing the effect of that. And with children too, remember, they're born and they born their gut immune system, zero, right? They have no bacteria, right? For the most part, they're sterile, right? So they need breast milk. They need mom. They need mom. They need the seed for their immune system, and that's where they get it, right? Their guts are leaky. They're born with a leaky gut, right? And then how many people do we see? Oh, we got to treat the leaky gut. And you're like, but yet children are born with that. And why is that? Because those immunoglobulins in breast milk are big. And they're not going to easily be crossing the digestive tract, right? So it's almost like we need that leaky gut to be able to say, okay, we can seed that system.
Yeah, the super absorptive, right?
Yeah. And we need mom, right? Mom's super important. Dad, who cares, right?
2 years, he'll be really fun.
Yeah, that's right. But first 2 years, right. But so that's just the idea. It's, again, just seeding that system properly. So another thing that I'm really big on, right, is I'm super big on bitters, right? I love bitters more than anything else, right? And I don't know, I guess, you know, I couldn't practice as a naturopath if I didn't use bitters and I didn't use DGL, right? Deglycerized licorice, like the two most important things kind of for the upper GI. But again, that's, you know, the bitters are so super important to just engage that digestive system, right? And I think that we even see that with kids, right? That it's just, they're not engaging. And the food allergy thing, right? I mean, again, don't eat gluten, don't eat dairy, don't eat soy, don't eat corn. I mean, I do that over and over and over, but it's not the food that's the problem, right?
That's a Band-Aid.
It's a Band-Aid. Yeah. It's the body's response to the food. Right. And and so how do we improve that response? And, you know, I'm with gluten, right? I mean, gluten, how many people have I seen that, you know, age 50 comes in, they're like, now I can't eat gluten. Or, Paul, ever since you took me off gluten, now I can't eat it. And it's like, oh, well, did I cause that? I'm not sure. Anyways, let's take a moment because I have to remind you all that you're listening to The Skeptical Naturopath and WDRT 91.9 in Viroqua, Wisconsin. And you're this is Paul Rutet and Laura Pomathis having a conversation about kids and microbiome. Anyway, so the bitter is super important, right? So they engage that. And I'm a, like, I don't know if a bilophile, if that's the right thing. Like, I get all caught up in bile production, right? So the bile is what's produced in the liver, and it's what we, you know, we, the gallbladder stores it, and then when we eat fat, it's ejected, and the bile, you know, kind of works to emulsify the fat and start that fat digestion. But what's super interesting, and there's actually, you know, research has gone in this direction too, is that the bile and the microbiome don't like each other. So, you know, the bile is constantly being conjugated. That's the chemical, the chemistry pathway. The bacteria will conjugate the bile and turn them into bile acids. So you got bile acids and they turn into bile salts, and we have different secondary and tertiary. But anyways, the interesting thing here is that the bile and the microbiome sort of fight each other. Like it's almost like it's a challenge. And this is the same thing like with the immune system that we kind of mentioned, right? The immune system is built by challenging the immune system. It's built by, you know, responding to a situation, not like living in isolation, right? Mm-hmm. Or living in a completely clean environment where we're not exposed to anything, right? But part of this is to get adaptability. And if we're trying to build that, is we actually have to get used to seeing these things. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so the bile and the microbiome, they don't like each other. And this is this concept of hormesis. Mm. I probably even said this to you already, and I've probably said this like six times on the show somewhere along the way. But hormesis is like low-dose stimulation, high-dose inhibition. So what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Yeah.
Right? So there's this constant fight that goes on. Or, you know, it's a challenge. It's actually a challenge on that microbiome to become stronger, right? So this is super interesting to me because, again, we can use probiotics, we can use fermented foods. I'm all for that, but that doesn't just work in isolation, mm-hmm. right? It's kind of like, but we've got to engage that digestive tract. And the bitters are such a simple way to do that, right? I mean...
Yeah, and they provide that challenge. That bitter taste is the challenge, right? And just like our immune system needs challenge and our, you know... Our microbiome needs that challenge. And I am obsessed with bitters. So I'm glad you like them because I talk about them all the time. I'm sure my family is like, yes, we'll take our bitters.
Go ahead.
Oh, and just like, you know, talking about, you mentioned SIBO and these overgrowths happening. I think bitters are hugely important for that because a lot of what I see is that we're getting overgrowth of these microbes in unwanted places or in unwanted amounts because the gut motility is so slow. So yes. Motility being, you know, how quickly things pass through the gut, which is, you know, kind of a function of our metabolism, but also the microbiome. And I see super slow motility. And so things are just kind of sitting in the gut and then they're fermenting or, you know, the bacteria are overgrowing because they're just sitting in the small intestine, which then you're getting endotoxins and you're not getting good absorption of nutrients. And I think those bitters are huge. So introducing even a really mild bitters to kids, I think is great to challenge the microbiome, to stimulate movement through the gut. And I think, you know, even something like, you know, if you can get, you know, a glyceride or an alcohol-free tincture for littles, but I also love a tea with super mild bitters like chamomile or lemon balm have mildly bitter properties, and kids love those, you know, in a tea or... I mean, maybe that's just my kids will drink tea.
Where do you start, right? This is, again, you know, for me and my boys, right, building that palate, mm-hmm. right? Building that palate because that palate is fat, salt, sweet. That's what we get. That's what we're bombarded with. And how do we develop those other tastes, right? Mm-hmm. And bitter is one of those, right?
It's the forgotten taste.
It's for sure the forgotten taste. And again, think bittersweet, mm-hmm. right? So, but then the whole idea of chocolate, right? Chocolate is bitter. And you're like, chocolate's not bitter. It's sweet. Yeah, because it's added sugar to it. You want the sugar. You don't want the chocolate. You want the sugar with a little bit of bitter there. But let's, you know, turn that around. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so it's like encouraging those other tastes. Maybe I told you this, that Gabriel and I will play the bitter game.
Oh, no, I don't
know. Oh, yeah, and you know the most bitter substance? What's the most bitter substance?
Wormwood?
Oh. Gentian.
Gentian, yeah.
Oh, my gosh, gentian. Yeah. Oh, so I have tinctures of those individually, mm-hmm. right? So we play this game, like how many bitters can you take? How many drops of gentian can you take?
Love that.
Oh, man. And, you know, it's just a game. So we do that. And we can play the milder one. Wormwood's still super bitter, too, but not quite as bad. Yep. Artichoke, now we're getting, you know, much milder on that dandelion. But just the idea of trying to build that palate to be like, oh, okay, well, that's bitter, and that's not necessarily bad. And a little bit of that, or just encouraging that to mm-hmm. not be, you know, to move away from the sweet and even into the, you know, the more bittersweet. I mean, do this with chocolate, right? You're eating 50%, you know, milk chocolate. You just go to 70% chocolate or go to 92% chocolate. I like 92% chocolate.
I love it.
Because you let it melt on your tongue, yes? Yeah. And then you can taste where the chocolate comes from. You get these nuances, right? It's like probably wine tasting or something. Mm-hmm. But it's the subtleness there, right? It's really learning to taste that and tasting those different bitters, right? So I like to use ginger mixed with gentian and a little bit of artichoke in it, right? So that's sort of what we do in my household, and those are motility agents too, right? Mm-hmm. They're moving the digestive system. Yeah. And I mean, constipation, I mean, what is constipation? And we can define that, but that's just, we need to engage that system. It's not just taking more fiber.
Yeah.
I mean, I love fiber and foods and that kind of thing, but still the idea we've got to engage that digestive system and it gets lazy and it's lax. And I see this in children, right?
So much constipation in children.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. I mean, every once in a while, here and there, you know, things happen or, you know, but I'm sure you do, chronic constipation in children. Yes. And I think, you know, fiber's great, like you said, but if you're just putting a bunch of bulk in something that's not moving, you can actually make it worse.
Yes.
So you need to address the motility. And I love what you said about gamifying it, you know, for kids and older kids. Like, that is such a great way to, you know, there's this kind of concept of playful parenting where you don't have to just force kids to do things, because if you want to engage their frontal lobe, like, play is a huge part, yes, of it. So even for, you know, kind of the latency phase, you know, 8, 9, 10-year-olds, teenagers too, you can gamify it. Like you said, that's so perfect. How bitter can you get? It's like those hot sauce shows, but with bitters. And I think but really to like start that palate is in utero, because yes, the baby in the belly actually tastes flavor compounds in the amniotic fluid.
Oh, that's so interesting. I've never thought about that. Thank yes. you, Laura. I mean, oh gosh.
And so if the mother during pregnancy is eating a diet rich in different flavor compounds, so eating bitters, you know, eating bitter foods, or taking, you know, pregnancy safe bitters and just a variety of different foods in general, the baby isn't exposed to that and gets their palate developed in utero, and then flavors come through the milk. And then when you're introducing first foods, you know, you're not going to start with rice cereal. You're going to start with liver and egg yolk and things yes. that have flavor and nutrients. And because I think, to me, flavor follows nutrients. and, you know, introducing the sauerkraut juice and the plain kefir and yogurt and these things. And then you can, you know, start adding bitters. I think things like lemon balm tea or chamomile tea or, you know, ginger tea, things that are mildly bitter, that definitely have bitter compounds,
yes,
but have some other flavors to kind of balance them out. You could start that at, you know, 6 months in small amounts and little sips. And certainly by a year, introducing little things like that. So, you know, I think you're talking about just the idea of movement with bitters. And I think something that I love to talk about when I talk about bitters is that there are bitter taste receptors in other places in the body, not just the tongue, which I think is so cool.
Yeah, it's in the stomach, right? And then, so we've had this debate, like, do you have to taste the bitter? And honestly, we don't even need to taste the bitter.
Yeah.
But the bitter taste tells you it's coming.
Yeah.
But the whole idea is we have those receptors that you could put those bitters in a pill
yeah.
and do that, and it'll have that effect because it stimulates hydrochloric acid yeah. production. So it stimulates the body, what it needs to make to start the protein digestion and engage that, right? That's a top-down issue mm-hmm. rather than using fiber, which I refer to as a bottom up, right? So that's now we're like trying to target and get movement there instead of saying, let's just engage that digestive system. It's super, super, super important. Mm-hmm. And this is just hygiene, right? This is, you don't even have to have a condition, right? I mean, mm-hmm. we can work on that, but it's just like, let's introduce these tastes. And, you know, and I think that's going to serve them very well when they're older, right? Because
yeah.
they're just used to that, mm-hmm. right? And they get used to those tastes instead of it's the fat, salt, sweet. And that's the problem in this culture, right? Is that the food industry is certainly enemy number one as far as I'm concerned,
sure.
right? They're not blameless in this. And they'll just say, well, that's what people want. That's what we do. I don't know.
Yeah.
Just how you are able to make a profit. Yeah. Anyway, so that let's go further. And so we get to that food allergy thing, right? And again, that's simple. We can do an elimination diet and just take foods out and you're like, I'm better. But yeah, but that's just, again, the idea that you've removed something, it's a symptom, it's a Band-Aid, mm-hmm. instead of saying, how do we really engage that immune system, right? Because what is a food allergy? And, you know, we talk about lactose intolerance, which is not an allergy, but an allergy really is to the protein.
Yeah.
Right, so it's a protein, and that sneaks through the lining of the gastrointestinal tract. It's not broken down properly. Then your immune system goes into overdrive, right? And
yeah.
70 to 80% of the immune cells in your body surround your gut. What does that tell you?
Yeah.
Like, super important.
Yeah.
Like, if something's there that doesn't belong there, the immune system gets engaged and works on that. So, again, that's a good segue now that we talk about the immune system,
mm-hmm.
right? And now we see chronic infections. We see all these kinds of things. And, like, where does that come from, right? And the immune system, understand, and we can talk about inflammation, we can talk about this kind of thing, but an autoimmune on some level. But the immune system is your body's response, right? This is not coming from outside. This is your body saying, oh, this is non-self. It's, you know, I got a problem. I need to fix this, or something's going on. And it triggers that immune system is engaged to say, hey, now I need to respond to that.
Yeah, it's doing its job.
It's doing its job.
It's an appropriate response.
Right? It's an appropriate response.
Yeah.
And that's the idea that do we want to shield it? And again, is the shield saying, well, I don't eat anything, or, you know, I'm going to live in a bubble and I don't get exposed to any viruses and no bacteria? I mean, how much bacteria are we consuming every day when we, you know, eat food?
Oh.
All the time.
So, yeah.
Strong stomach acid neutralizes that.
Yes.
Right?
So, and that's part of it. It's robust immune system and digestive system is that strong stomach acid.
Exactly. So yeah. Stomach acid is good for you, mm-hmm. right? Oh my gosh. And bitters are the simple way to do that, right? Bitters, you start early. I mean, we can use hydrochloric acid. We can do, you know, other things too. But I really like engaging the system to do better. And it just fits, right? This mm-hmm. fits so beautifully with children,
yeah.
right?
Especially when you talk about a modern mismatch, because that's so, you know, that flavor so missing in the diet, that's something easy to correct to make it match our kind of our biological kind of expectation, right? Our body has these bitter receptors, so it expects bitter foods to engage them, and if we don't engage them, then there's going to be symptoms. So just like everything, if we have a biological expectation, and it, like for movement or for you know, sunlight or whatever, if it's unmet, there's going to be symptoms, because our body's saying symptoms are good, right? Symptoms are our body saying, hey, we're not getting something we need, and then you can do something about it.
That's right. So we see all these things. So we see anxiety, we see depression, we see these sleep disorders, we see all these things. And again, it's like, what's underlying that?
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I need to go outside. And you know, and again, developing this healthy immune system, I think, is that microbiome. So here we're talking about both digestion as well as immune function, right? And really to meet up to the challenges, right? We don't want to remove the challenges, and we have an environment that's certainly challenging with other things,
yeah.
but that, you know, how do we do better when we get an infection, right? So how do we encourage that immune system to be able to respond properly and clear that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is sort of this like fever thing. Like, a fever is not necessarily a bad thing. It's the fever is the body's response, right? It's the idea that, hey, I got to turn the temperature up. The hypothalamus gets involved and says, let's turn the temperature up because we got a clean house here,
yeah.
right? And it cleans house. And oftentimes, I've seen this with my boys for sure, as well as patients, is that a fever is actually, you know, the precursor to a growth spurt.
Absolutely.
Right? So it's like the body's reconstructing. So is the idea that we want to avoid the fever, again, it's not avoidance, it's not isolation, it's trying to get us to be stronger, right? Trying to get us to be more resilient.
Absolutely.
So, and have exposure, and try to like not just be like, oh, I can't eat gluten, dairy, and soy, and, you know, these kinds of things, to just say, can we strengthen that system? And mm-hmm. I think early on we can. At age 50, oof, a lot harder. Yes.
More of an uphill battle. Yeah. And I think viewing childhood illness in a different light as a way of saying strengthening that immune system, and as a form of, you know, a form of somewhat healthy stress on the body, you know,
yes.
stress in quotes. But I think, you know, there's certainly a limit. You know, kids should not be sick all the time.
Yes.
That's a sign. If you're getting RSV 2-3 times a year,
yes.
or they're, you know, having allergies, or they're constantly sick, that's certainly a sign. But, you know, an illness once or twice a year, a fever once or twice a year,
yes.
to get to the next level of development, or get you a growth spurt, I think those are, you know, symptoms are showing that our body's actually healing from something. And I think that's, you know, something to reconsider, like you're talking about, like exposure is a good thing, because it's going to challenge and strengthen us. And I think about like my little one who, when she got chickenpox, she was 9 months. So, you know, on the young side, but we had a chance to get it. So we got it. The day after all of her sores went away, she started crawling. Like, the day.
Yeah, that's amazing.
You know, she'd been trying to, you know, they do the rocking thing, and they try to crawl, and it had been weeks, which is, you know, that how they learned. But, I mean, it was just the day everything got better, she started crawling immediately. And it's like you get these, get to these next childhood development kind of milestones, and you get to a next level of growth through the strengthening and adaptation and letting those things happen. Of course, you don't want them to have a fever of 106 or something, but
that's right.
101, like, let their body heal, and, you know, keep an eye on it. And, you know, but there's, I think changing our mindset, is huge. Letting kids play in the mud, letting yes. kids, you know, be kids, and I think mindset's huge, and I think that's a big mismatch, is what we kind of have in our minds of what is good for kids and what we need to control and what we need to also just let happen, I think is a mismatch.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, that's the immune system and the gut go hand in hand mm-hmm. here, right? What else do we have on there? Let's talk about nervous system. Oh, yeah, thanks. It's time for an update. So you are listening to the Skeptical Naturopath on WDRT 91.9 in Viroqua, Wisconsin. And this is Dr. Paul Rattay and Laura Poe Mathis, and we're talking about the various childhood mismatches. So let's talk about that nervous system and stress, mm-hmm. right? So that's another variable that also affects the gastrointestinal tract, right? So again, we can't stray too far from that gastrointestinal tract. So, yep. right, we talked about the second brain and the first brain, yes? So the second mm-hmm. brain's in the gut and all this information that's being transacted. So what about this first brain, right? And what about the stress of being a child, the stress of school, the stress of that? What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I think stress... Yeah, I think there's good kinds of stress. Exactly what we've been talking about, the hormesis, there's good kinds, but I think so many modern children are being exposed to too much of what I would say is the wrong kind of stress, whether it's overstimulation
yes.
from screens or, you know, all number of things. And I think, you know, there's a lot of different kinds of unwanted stress, whether it's ultra-processed foods or just, you know, or getting too much artificial light, or not getting enough, you know, exposure to nature. I think there's a huge kind of emotional stressor for kids is not having strong attachment. So, you know, I'm a big believer in things like, you know, baby wearing and co-sleeping and breastfeeding and these things, because they help children learn to co-regulate, because yes. at first children cannot self-soothe. They cannot regulate their own nervous system. They're learning from you. And so, I mean, honestly, step one in having a kid with a regulated nervous system is regulating your own nervous system yes. and healing your own inner child. Because, like, if you aren't regulated, your kids can't learn to be regulated. They're not going to just necessarily do it on their own. So I think working on your own self, but then, you know, having that super close attachment and bond with mom and even with dad. And I think there's so many things that start just immediately upon birth that start to shape the stress response in the nervous system, which in, you know, my lens is like really all dysfunction and disease is because of stressors, and whether yes. they're physical or whether they're emotional or, you know, whatever. But that when we have too much of the wrong kinds of stress, I think that's where everything's coming from. And I think it just starts so early for kids now. Yeah, I could go on a lot, but I think those are some of the things that I think of, you know, when at the top of my head for like, what are the first kind of things that are shaping the kid's nervous system are those kind of immediate things right after birth.
Right. And then, you know, this gets into the whole sort of HPA axis, right? Mm-hmm. Hypothalamus, pituitary, adrenal. And, you know, in my world, it's, oh, everybody's got adrenal stress, right? Adrenal fatigue. That's your problem. Let's support your adrenals and everything will be good to go. Oh, man, I wish it was that simple. Mm-hmm. Yes. And again, it's sort of the Band-Aid approach. But, you know, to understand, again, with stress, there's sort of good stress and then bad stress. There's sort of the point at which the scale tips. Mm-hmm. And this changes over time as well, right? So how much can we manage? How much can we put on that scale before it tips? And so we've already talked about the gut. We've talked about foods. We've talked about other things that will tip that scale. And again, then we just, you know, throw stress on top of that. But again, it's when the good stress becomes bad, and it's just being the kind of overwhelmed part, right? It's the
yes.
the flight or fight, or flight, fight, or freeze, or actually flight, fight, or freeze, or fawn. So there's kind of the four Fs that go with the mm-hmm. the sympathetic nervous system, right? And the sympathetic, you know, is we're built to deal with a bear, and if the bear is there, we're gonna stimulate that whole adrenal process to say we got to run, we got to fight, because we may not be alive 10 minutes from now,
yeah.
right? And that's a basic human thing, right? Is that we need that flight or fight. On the flip side of that, we have this, the parasympathetic nervous system, right? So the parasympathetic is rest and digest. Mm-hmm. So we've got rest and digest, and we've got flight or fight. That pretty much tells you everything right there, yes? Yeah. So the problem with this culture that I see is that we're stuck in flight or fight. Mm-hmm. That we're and that's not the way it's supposed to be. We're right. supposed to be in rest and digest, yeah. and we go to flight or fight when we need to, and then we go back to rest and digest.
Yeah, it's a tool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and that's, we call that the autonomic nervous system, right? Or the automatic nervous system. Like, we don't really consciously control that. Unconsciously, things that we do, self-soothing, all these things that happen early childhood, they set us up to be able to manage that better, right? Mm-hmm. Versus childhood trauma and all this other things that's going to set that up to be very skewed toward, you know, fight or flight. Mm-hmm. And again, that's survival,
yeah.
right? And we remember that. That's the thing about that nervous system too, is that we remember things, right? So that something that's happened before, we can kind of pattern that to happen in the future as well. So that if we're confronted with that, we can respond appropriately, right? It's just like antibodies on some level. Antibodies mm-hmm. respond to a foreign antigen. In this case, now we're dealing with some kind of foreign thing, whatever that event was, that we sort of have some remembrance and we go into this response. And anxiety is basically like you're in flight or fight and you don't really know why, right? So something sort of triggered that yeah. and you're in that flight or fight response. And again, that's appropriate. I mean, that's the right, that's a response. Yeah. It's just like, what's the input?
Yeah, right? Humans are almost too good at it.
Yeah, we're too good, right? And
yeah, we're really good at it. And that's where that mismatch comes in, right? Like we are, our bodies are so well adapted to that, but the modern culture is constantly bombarding us with stimulation yeah. to be in our
in flight or flight.
So then it's like, of course you're going to be stuck there. So, and those can be, you know, physical inputs, whether, you know, which is like the blood sugar roller coaster, yes. or it could be the, you know, stressors from the news or, you know, all sorts of things, or just not even having good tools to get ourselves back into, you know, self, you know, to soothing and to get ourselves calm and regulated. And I think, there's a really good book. You've probably read it, The Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers.
Love it. Sapolsky. Robert Sapolsky. It's the best lecture I ever saw was by him. Oh, my God. Yeah. He is fantastic.
Great book.
I don't know if he's retired. He's a neuropsychology. His anthropology is part of that. He studies the chimpanzees, or he did study the chimpanzees in Africa. Mm-hmm. But, oh, my gosh, yeah, why zebras don't get ulcers. So why don't you summarize that? I love that, but I'll let you do that.
Yeah, just the idea that, like, you know, all animals and mammals, I guess, have this ability to go into fight or flight and get their adrenaline going if they need to run from a lion or some sort of, you know, threat. And then the body returns to rest and digest very quickly afterwards because, yes. The threat's gone. But the modern culture is constantly bombarding us with stressors. And so we're just stuck in fight or flight. So, but, you know, something like a wild animal, a zebra, and, you know, talking about the title, is able to go, oh, the lion's gone. Stress is over. I can go about my regular life and I'm happy again. And when the lion comes back, they go back into that mode. And so, but humans are getting stuck. And so we're getting these stress hormones just constantly kind of pumping through our bodies. And that's leading to disease. And so, you know, the idea of something like an ulcer, of course, we know that something like an H. pylori and things cause ulcers. But why would the H. pylori be overgrown? Yes. Because of stress. So, I think that's a great book for even a layperson to kind of dive into what's going on with the nervous system. And
it's fantastic. Yeah, you know, I remember the anecdote in there where he was in a cardiologist's office and they looked at the chairs. And that the people that were in there, they would wear out the chairs because they're under so much stress that they're doing things with their hands. There's a little anecdote in there on, mm-hmm. on that. Oh my God, it's fantastic. It's a fantastic yeah. read, easy read. It's really old, but mm-hmm. certainly super relevant still, right? And again, so this is gets to sleep stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So this is the rest and digest. That's where we should be living, but we end up being in flight or fight. And think about that too, right? Social media and everything else, like 80% of the news is negative. Why? Because if we get a hit on the sympathetic nervous system, it's going to sell, right? That's how they sell things, mm-hmm. right? Negative sells better than positive sells. Fear is much more motivating than joy.
Yeah.
Right? Pain is super motivating for human beings, yes?
Yeah.
So again, so we have this, and how many people, I mean, I see lots of people, and children too, they're not sleeping, right? Yeah. The sleep is off, and it's like, oh, well, why are you stuck in flight or fight when you're sleeping, right? You should be dreaming about pink giraffes and purple elephants, right? Yeah. That's what's supposed to happen, and that's not happening. It's almost like they're processing, they're still in flight or fight, and they're processing their day, and they're working, and they're studying or doing whatever while they're sleeping. Mm. I had that once in undergrad. I actually studied while I slept. It was for a political science midterm or political science exam. Oh my God, I aced it.
Aren't you efficient?
That only happened once though. Yeah. I didn't figure out how to reproduce that. But probably I was in flight or fight, right?
Yeah.
So how do we encourage that rest and digest? And it's almost like, oh, what do I take before I go to sleep at night? But oh no, how do you do things during the day to downregulate that immune system, right? Mm-hmm. And we have a nasty culture where we're used to using caffeine to get going in the morning and alcohol to bring us down at night. This is not the way to manage our nervous system. I mean, I don't know that I worry about kids so much, although caffeine and Red Bull and all that other stuff. Oh my goodness.
My gosh.
But you know that it works though, right?
Of course.
I mean, so it stimulates that whole adrenal system, right? So you're alive, you're alert, you're in the game. That's adrenaline, right?
Yeah.
Epinephrine. And that we feel good on that. But the problem is it's not going to last forever. It's short acting.
Yeah.
And then it goes away.
No? Yeah, especially with kids, like, you know, I think small amount of caffeine has been shown to be nootropic and all these things. But these kids are consuming hundreds of milligrams or more. And without any sort of like balance of like enough protein and like a well-balanced breakfast. And they're riding that all day.
Yes.
It's just so common. And we're just kind of, I feel like people have just given up. They're like, yeah, that's what my kids drink. It's like, you got to be the gatekeeper.
Yeah, that's right.
And of course, kids, I mean, I have a 15-year-old at home. I know that kids can be sneakier. They're going to do whatever they want, but there's got to be some, I think holding boundaries is huge with all the things we've talked about. You know, I think when we chatted earlier talking about like, am I the bad guy? Do
yes.
I let them do whatever they want? I think there's still, I think holding strong boundaries and being a good example is so important. And
Yeah, and so, and again, this is the physical activity piece. This is about doing those other things to say, and think about it, flight or fight. So you see a bear, and what happens? You flight, fight, fawn, or freeze. But the whole idea is your body's telling you to run, fight. So at the very least, right, to externalize a stress response would mean go outside and run around the building 3 times,
yeah.
right? I mean, that's just a sense if that's building up, that's what your body's telling you to do. Do what your body's telling mm-hmm. you what to do. At the very least. Right, instead of sort of having those stress hormones and they're built up and you don't really aren't doing anything at it, or you're just sitting in a classroom, or you know, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that's at least an externalization thing, but perhaps even more important is to try to figure out how do you downregulate that, you know, that stress response. So how do you get to a point that you don't like overreact to every situation?
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's everything that you've been talking about is that imprinting early on in life, right? To try to set the plate to say, hey, maybe I've just got a more resilient kid because I put some of the work in on the front end, because that front end work is so valuable.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the idea of trying to figure out where do we get the movement? Where do we get the physical activity? How do we like work on that self-soothing thing, right? And having that dang phone and before you go to bed and the stimulation before bed, I mean, the sleep hygiene, oh my goodness,
mm-hmm.
terrible, right? So is there just sort of this sense like what's our rules of engagement, right? So in my house, I'll unplug my router, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I unplug the router and then it's done, right? And then it's all of a sudden, okay, well, the computer and everything else is kind of useless because you can't go online.
Yeah.
So then it's just like, oh, well, now we've got this transition before we go to sleep, right? And it's just like now it's off. And well, I guess I shouldn't say this. I don't know if Gabriel listens or not, but so I don't unplug it any longer. later. But it's just a sense that we've got this rhythm going that it's like, I'm tired, I need to go to bed, right?
Yeah.
And there's this sort of transition, and we're not on the phone or we're not on the devices to just say, okay, well, that's all kind of done. Let's just allow some time to adapt to be able to get to that. And I mean, I'll give Gabriel credit there, because he will... I mean, I will leave him up on weekends or that kind of thing, and I still don't know, but the level is, I think that he's going to bed, like he's trying to get into the rhythm much better than my older boys,
yeah,
about being having this sense like, I got to go to sleep. I need to sleep. I'm tired, right? And at the very least, that's a beginning point to say, oh, I'm going to consciously choose to turn this off rather than have constant stimulation.
Yeah, I think... Yeah, I mean, that's great. I'm pure evil and don't have Wi-Fi.
Oh, you're... Oh, great.
I mean, we have the internet, but it's not wireless. But I think the... I think what you use the word transition, which I think for kids is enormous. So I think... And, of course, the biggest one is a transition from wake to sleep. And
yes,
that, you know, like dimming the lights or just having candles and not having screens. And it's time for reading and for, you know, calm things. But I think just throughout the day, a great way to regulate a kid's nervous system is to really honor those transitions, whether it's in the morning, getting ready to go to school if they're doing school or whatever activity. And then after school, a transition from school to home. I think honoring that space for children, especially very young children, is really huge. And you know, you can give them a cup of lemon balm tea,
yes,
which is also a Nervine.
Yes.
And, you know, these little rituals and habits and routines are huge for kids. And that's a really big part of nervous system regulation for children, is they have an expectation and it's met, and then their nervous system feels safe. And transitions are huge. But this sleep one is big. And I think, you know, things like massage for children, or maybe with a magnesium oil, or doing an Epsom salt bath to get them the magnesium, and these just the change in vibes, you know. And, you know, sometimes some kids at the end of the day are like, have all their wiggles to get out or whatever. But I think the parent being the leader of whether, pardon me, the whatever it is, the food or the movement or the transition to sleep, the vibes is really, it's a really important job.
Yeah. So do you know Arm Lavender Rose? Do you know that formula from Uriel Pharmacy? It's
mm-hmm.
an anthroposophic remedy.
Okay.
So I actually talk about this in the lecture. So it's a cream. So it has Arum, which is gold. So it's homeopathic gold, lavender, mm-hmm. rose. Oh my God, it smells fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And you can use that. So it's like a cream, and you can put it on your third eye. You can put it over your adrenal glands. You can put it on the soles of your feet. You put it on your, over your heart. Oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
So calming, right? So there's sort of this like almost a ritual kind of thing that
mm-hmm.
you just like, there's the smells, there's this kind of thing to get into that rhythm to say, now I'm ready for sleep,
mm-hmm.
right? Super important. Rescue Remedy is another,
mm-hmm.
you know, super simple thing that people can use and you know, just to kind of, you know, downregulate that stress response
mm-hmm.
on some level, right? Because that's super important. I mean, there's all sorts of life skills too with this, but, you know, these are some simple crutches that can kind of just help with that transition, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, super important. Anyways, we're out of time. And you know what? I think we kind of covered all five. I mean, we got to the sleep thing. We got to the movement within that. So I think we did pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Laura. Well, I hope you come back. I hope I haven't scared you away. So thank you for listening to Skeptical Naturopath with Dr. Paul Rite and Laura Poe Mathis. You're listening to WDRT 91.9 in Viroqua, Wisconsin. And we'll see you next time.